some pleasure that I welcome our two speakers to our college this afternoon. On my extreme right, we have Sir Keith Joseph, who is well known for his participation with the Conservative Party. And on my immediate left, we have Mr. Edward Hardy, who is a leading light, shall I say, in the Socialist Party of Great Britain. You're all here, presumably, because you hope to see some good debate. And this is why we're all here. And I would ask those people who have come directly concerned with either of the main speakers, if they could, during the course of the debate, bear in mind the underlying ideas that we had when we set out to put this debate on, and that is to promote some sort of discussion and dialogue among students about political ideals and philosophies. That, by that, I don't mean that I don't want to see any sort of contribution from those supporters, but I will, in the event of seeing several hands up, go first to those student members, and secondly, to those members who have come with either of the main speakers. I think, therefore, without more ado, I shall ask Sir Keith Joseph if he would like to step up to the rostrum microphone and deliver his opening address. Sir Keith Joseph.
Now, and with respect to my opponent, I will develop part of the case for capitalism. There are broadly three different forms of organizing society. There's mutual agreement that's very suitable for a small society, a family arrangement, suitable for a kibbutz, a large family, even a very, 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 very small society, but not faintly conceivably relevant to a nation even of our time. Then there is what is called a market system, where goods and services are produced and supplied according to the demand for them, as evidenced by the price mechanism and by profit and loss under the pressures of competition. That's the market system. Prices are a signaling device indicating what people want and what people don't want. Every time a choice is made, every time a particular goods, piece of goods or services is chosen, that is chosen and others are rejected. The signal goes back instantaneously along hundreds of thousands of lines of communication to all the suppliers, the distributors and the producers. And in search for profit within the law and under competition, the producers and distributors will seek to make and to stock and to supply that which people show by their purchases that they want. And the signaling system, the profit system, is a constant automatic mechanism for moving resources, men, women, raw materials, money, from goods and services that are not desired to goods and services that are desired. That's the market mechanism. And I accept it as the best mechanism there is. Only I add to it one word. I call it the social market mechanism, because we want to frame that market within humane laws and services. And the third method of organizing an economy or a society is the command mechanism, where the prices are laid down and the goods and services to be produced are laid down centrally by some committee, by a bureaucracy, by a civil service. And that is the command mechanism, that is the mechanism adopted with variance by all the centralized societies. It's the Marxist mechanism, it's the mechanism used by most of the variants of a dictatorship or a centralized society. Now, it's not my job today to be rude to anybody, or I'm not going to impute anybody's motives, but we have these three choices. Now, normally, on occasions like this, I am setting up the market mechanism against the command mechanism. But today, I have a very unusual and agreeable opponent who is as much, I understand, against the command mechanism as I am. Is that correct? So I don't have to take my time arguing with Mr. Hardy about the third alternative. Mr. Hardy, in the purest possible way, I understand, is in favour of the first mechanism. That is, the family mechanism. We make our decisions among ourselves, what to produce and what to sell and what to make. Now, when I talk of goods and services, ladies and gentlemen, I am talking of goods and services and amenities. I'm not talking just today of vulgar concepts like washing machines, very valuable though they are, very civilizing though they are, for using the work of women and men. I'm talking of the whole range of goods and services and amenities. And the question before us is which is the best way to provide for a population that combination, the optimum combination of freedom, choice, prosperity, and humanity. Those four. Anyone could set up a system that produced one or two of those, but our task is to find a system that serves the optimum combination of all those four. Prosperity, freedom, choice, and humanity. Now, in a very small and very simple society that limited itself to simple needs, to the satisfaction of simple needs, I conceded at once that Mr. Hardy's system could work. In the extreme case, Swiss Family Robinson. A family expanded to a kibbutz, perhaps expanded to a larger agricultural community, could organize its own affairs by a mass meeting of several hundred people making decisions about what to do. But we're not dealing with a society of that size. We're dealing with 55 million people. And we're not dealing with simple needs. Let me take one example. I happen to be very glad, despite all the difficulties, that I live today with anaesthetics available. Now, if you're going to have a very simple society, you can't say, well, I want a simple life, but I would like my anaesthetics, please. Because anaesthetics, the syringes that apply them, all the medical monitoring and other equipment that goes with the diminution of pain, involves a combination of learning, of training, of production, of skills, of services, of buildings, of transport, that just doesn't go with a simple society. So I hope Mr. Hardy isn't going to set up for this country some utopia in his talk that eliminates the sort of things such as anaesthetics that we tend, most of us, to take for granted. If a politician went before people in this country and said, no more anaesthetics, we're going to have a simple life, we're going to abolish the capitalist system, we're not going to have a Marxist system, we're going to organise our own affairs, then he would come up against great troubles because the people want anaesthetics. I don't mean opium for the masses, I was thinking of pain pills. The problem that Mr. Hardy has to deal with is this. How, in a society organized as he wishes it to be organized, where goods and services are only produced for use and not for profit, how in such a society do producers decide what people want to use? How, in a command society, it's very easy. A number of civil servants sit together and they say we'll have 5% more radios of this sort or that sort next year, and 4% more agricultural taxes. They're almost always wrong, because in a society, billions of decisions are made every day, and no central committee can possibly decide what people are going to need. The weather is changing, tastes are changing, passions are changing, inventions are occurring, developments are occurring, delays occur. How can a central committee make decisions that are going to satisfy people? How can Mr. Hardy's, as it were, family arrangement decide what people are going to need? We're a complicated society with an infinite number of ways of using the resources in goods and services and amenities. Are we going to have more money spent on reducing pollution? Are we going to spend money reducing noise? Or are we going to spend more money on having more meat? Now, these are decisions that have to be made centrally in Mr. Hardy's organization. They have to be made by a group getting together to make these decisions with all their infinite complexity and repercussions. Say, the market system doesn't try to make these decisions centrally at all. It sets up the market system by a framework of law, by imposing competition, harnesses the interest, the self-interest of each individual producer and supplier to the public interest. Because the market system is based on this proposition. You only make a profit if you produce or sell what people, by buying your product or service, show they want at the price available. You are producing what people want, or the thing that they choose out of the choice available, and if you don't produce and supply what they want, you don't make a profit. Now, of course, the market system is imperfect in this country, because we haven't organized ourselves properly. My case for being a conservative, I believe, reformer, is to create a better framework for the market system to work well. We have not regarded profit as an honourable purpose in this country. We have constantly fiddled around with the... I have not... Can you tell me how I'm going about this? Another 6 minutes. We have not respected profit. We've not enforced competition. We haven't rewarded talent. We have made many blunders in our attitude to profit, to the market system, conservatives and Labour alike. But the market system is the system that potentially offers the best combination of freedom, choice, humanity, and prosperity that there is in a society of our size with some large range of sophistication in demand. The market system is based on widespread decision-making, very widespread decision-making, infinite number of individual producers, of small firms, of medium-sized firms, of large firms. The market system is based on a decentralization of ownership. The market system is based on central decisions only on subjects that individuals cannot decide for themselves. It is not possible for individuals to decide whether they shall spend a lot of money reducing pollution from their factory. Because if I spend a lot of my money reducing pollution from my factory and my neighbour doesn't, then my neighbour produces goods cheaper than I do, and the air is polluted. So there has to be a law about pollution. So the central government in the market system lays down laws that apply to all, and the amount of pollution we allow is for the central government's decision, but it applies to everybody. The central government in a market system lays down the laws about humanity, about the services providing for looking after people when they have to change jobs, when there's unemployment, when they're ill. The market system is perfectly compatible with a humane society. And the market system, because of the decentralization of ownership, because of the spread of independence, is the only system, I believe, that really provides freedom for those five crucial people for any civilization: the inventor, the critic, the reformer, the writer, and the artist. These are the five people who contribute most to any culture or civilization. In a market society, they can live, work, by seeking support from any one of hundreds of thousands of different owners of funds. Let me put this in a graphic form. The man who has changed the life of the world most, I suppose, in the last 150 years, was Karl Marx. Karl Marx spent all his life as a scholar. There weren't grants for scholars in his day. Who supported him? He was supported by a Manchester businessman called Engels, whose family kept Karl Marx. Now, in the market society, which Britain was then and is still to some extent now, Marx was able to go not to a government as in a command society, but to an individual, and he could have gone to thousands of other individuals, and get the patronage of that individual in order to write what proved to be explosive works. That is just an example of the freedom to the writer, the critic, the reformer, that decentralized ownership in a market society provides, and that centralized ownership in a command society denies. I have to say to Mr. Harding that in a society of our size, it would just not conceivably be possible to organize our affairs except on the simplest, crudest basis.
by mutual agreement. There are far too many complicated choices to be made. Now, finally, have I got one moment? How long? 5 minutes. Finally, let me come out of the spheres and put to you several arguments you might put to me. You might say to me, do you mean to say you're standing there and supporting profit? You believe in profit? Well, yes, I do, provided it's earning competition. And then you might press me and say, but how on earth can you justify the mess, for instance, made by cotton mills and the enormous profits they make? Well, I would say to you that property is a proper function. Somebody's got to decide what to build. Somebody's got to decide to take risk by building something that may or may not be wanted. The fault with the property problem was that governments, successive governments, including the government in which I served, inflated the currency so much that there were very large profits. Many of the people who made those profits have gone bankrupt since. If we hadn't inflated, property would still have been a very risky game where profit would have been earned only in relation to the risk taken. Because the only justification for profit is risk. That is the only justification. And the heart of the difference between the market system and the command system, the heart of the difference between the market system and the system Mr. Hardy may speak for, is that the people who decide in the market system what to produce and what to sell gain profit if they get their decision right and make losses if they get their decision wrong. And they're far more likely to get the decision right if they gain and lose in that way than are civil servants or officials whose career will go on whether they get the decision right or wrong. A civil servant goes through a career, perhaps making wrong decisions the whole while, and finishes up with a knighthood in the House of Lords because he's never had any benefit when his decisions are right or suffered any loss when his decisions are wrong. That is not true in a market. And if you say to me, well, look at housing in this country, there's your market and what a mess it's made. I say to you, housing has not made a mess. It's government interference with the market for housing that's made a mess. And if you say to me, well, your system produces scandal, I would say to you, any system produces scandal. We in a market economy have a free press that exposes those scandals when they can be discovered. Do you not think there are scandals in command societies? Even in the utopia which Mr. Hardy may describe, there would still be human nature with its weaknesses. There would always be weaknesses when dealing with human nature. And finally, my last argument. What I'm talking about is not just a benefit theory. The central importance of human nature, the central importance of putting decisions on the shoulders of people who stand to gain if the decision is right and to lose if the decision is wrong, that's the market system, is shown to benefit the people on the ground. Our standard of living is now far, far less than it should. We used to have the fourth best standard of living in the world 20 years ago. We're now the 20th and going down fast. But look in countries that do respect profit. Look at countries that don't nationalize. Look at countries like Switzerland. Look at countries like Holland or West Germany. You will find those countries contain people far wealthier. They contain far more millionaires per million population than we have here. Their standard of living is far higher. Their social services are far better than ours. And you have to search those countries to find poor people. Oh, I know the Germans keep their poor in Turkey, but broadly, they have achieved success through the market mechanism, combining freedom under the rule of law, prosperity, and humanity beyond what we've achieved, because we have crippled our social market economy by both parties adopting semi-command, semi-socialist approaches. So I'm here to urge you to look at how social market society can work. Look at Switzerland. That is how we could be. We could be as prosperous, as humane as that, if we apply the sort of techniques I've been describing.
As you know, of course, Sir Keith Joseph, who's a member of the Tory party, is here defending, putting the case for capitalism. I, as a socialist, am putting a case against capitalism. But in fact, this first part of this debate has been taken out of the description of what is called the market economy. But what I find exceedingly difficult to follow is this. I can follow the argument. My opponent suggests that you can have a sort of small family society where things can be arranged directly and democratically. But you cannot apply that kind of thing to a larger society. He has in mind country of the size of the United Kingdom. And he proceeded to explain how, in his view, his market economy would work, in which the consumers, in effect, would be the people who would call the tune. What they wanted, they would get. Well, what I want to draw your attention to is this. I find it impossible to reconcile this description of the market economy with the thing we have actually got, which is capitalism, and which you've had for a couple of hundred years. Capitalism does not behave like this. And it seems to me there's a great gulf between the world of reality, which is the world of capitalism, and the one that you have been asked to consider as an alternative. But it is not an alternative. We've got to face capitalism as it really is. Now, knowing that I was speaking second, and having done debates before, I expected to find, as we always have, that people defending capitalism will put a case in its defense and will talk about socialism in a way that we do not accept. And I must therefore spend some time, although our time is very brief, reminding you what capitalism really is. And I'm talking about capitalism in this country, in this century, in the last century, under liberal and Tory and Labour governments. And the capitalism, the wealth is produced by the working class, the wage and salary earners, who are the great majority of the population. They man the industry, they provide all the managerial, scientific, technical and other functions, they run the administration, they are in fact the people who keep society going. But they don't own the means of production and distribution, the mills, mines, factories and so on. They do not own the product of the wealth they produce is sold by the owners in order to make a profit. And it is essential, and my opponent has recognized this, it is essential to capitalism that there should be profit. When profit cannot be made, capitalists and investors generally stop investing. They curtail investment, they curtail production, workers are thrown on the unemployed market. Now, there is always unemployment under capitalism, there always has been. At intervals, capitalism goes through its normal phases, its expansion, its boom, its crisis, its stagnation, its depression. And in those periods of depression, the unemployment army rises. And this has been going on in capitalism ever since it began. You've got perhaps a dozen crises in the 19th century and great depressions like the one that lasted for nearly 20 years towards the end of the century. Now, what we are saying about capitalism, and I remind you that in economics we are Marxists, we say that capitalism cannot be run in any other way. This is normal to capitalism. When there's a crisis, it doesn't mean that capitalism's gone wrong. It goes through this cycle, always, and nothing whatever can be done about it. Now, if it is suggested to you that you can give this another name and call it a market economy, and it is going to behave differently, I'm sceptical, and you should all be sceptical. Why should it behave differently? It is still the same old capitalism, and it always has behaved like this. It has never been changed. You had dozens of alternative policies put forward for running capitalism. Take the Tory Party. The Tory Party originally were protectionists. Then they became free traders. Then they became protectionists again. And in recent years, of course, they have gone in for all these variations of incomes policy under different names. And it hasn't made any difference whatever to capitalism. And then they have gone in the 1930s, for another broad variety of running capitalism. Come back to this. After the Great Depression, at the end of the 19th century, in which the Liberals and Tories were quite incapable of stopping it or doing anything about it, just took its course, and another depression in the 1920s, there was a growing recognition among the workers in the trade unions and even in the universities that perhaps Marx was right. Perhaps capitalism does run like this and perhaps nothing can be done about it. And then a shocking blight fell on the world. It had a name. It was John Maynard Keynes. Keynes came along and said, look, Marx was wrong. He was unscientific, has no application. You don't have to worry about capitalism. You can control it. You can make capitalism do what you like. You can have full employment. You can have no more crises. And even threw in as a bonus, you can get rid of war because you won't have this international competition that capitalism inevitably leads to. And as actually, from the point of view of the working class and the socialist movement, this was an undiluted tragedy. It set them back for 30 or 40 years because, unfortunately, it was swallowed by all of them. They all believed in Keynes. And among those who believed in Keynes was the Tory Party, the Liberal Party, and the Labour Party. Now, I want to come back to this market economy again to say to you, this market economy is just the same old unregenerate capitalism given a new name. There are people, of course, who are trying to give a new face to capitalism. Peter Walker had a go last year about giving a new face to capitalism, and Short for the Labour Party did the same. But Peter Walker also said something else which is interesting. Peter Walker defined the new Tory Party and its attitude to capitalism. He said the Tory Party is the party of Disraeli and Keynes. And Pardo for the Liberal Party came back smartly and said the Liberal Party is the party of Beveridge and Keynes. Beveridge was a man who, you remember, inquired into and organised social service changes after the Second World War. Wilson, of course, didn't have to say it, because the Labour Party has always been Keynesian in the last 30 years, and Wilson has put it on record that all three of those parties are Keynesian. Now, that has been, as I say, a disaster. They have not got capitalism under their control. They have not solved the unemployment problem. They have not got full employment. In fact, they have all of them now abandoned it. They no longer, the Labour Party no longer promises jobs for all, neither do the others. They accept the fact that capitalism means unemployment. And this crisis that we are in at the moment, I notice no particular reference is made to it, we are in a crisis now. This is the crisis that the Keynesians, which is Liberal, Labour and Tory, all said would never happen. We are in it, this is what has happened. Well, all one can hope out of this is that somebody learns something about it, and that they go back and recognise that Marx was right, that Keynes was wrong when he said that Marx had no application. It's Keynes that was the misleading influence on the modern world. Capitalism is what it always was, and there is nothing that any of them can do about it. I have listened to this talk about the market economy. I would like to put a question to my opponent, and that is this. If it is suggested that something different is going to happen in the capitalism of the future, we know in the past that everything has been tried. Free trade, protection, Britain in the Empire, Britain in EFTA, now Britain in Europe. It doesn't make any difference. All of these policies in the past have failed, including all the incomes policies. If we are offered something new in the future, what is it to be? What is the Tory Party going to offer as a means of running capitalism? Are they going to revive some of these old failed policies, or are they going to introduce a new one, and if so, what it is? A reference is made to nationalisation. Well, let us make our position absolutely clear on this. The Socialist Party has never on any occasion supported nationalisation. Nationalisation is state capitalism, and when we say we're opposed to capitalism, we are opposed to capitalism, private or state. It makes no difference whatever. We are Marxists, and this is what Marx was dealing with. Marx's conception of socialism, which is the one we have, is, and we're getting right to the crux of a situation here, Marx's conception of socialism was that you do not have a wages system, a prices system, you don't have profit, you don't have buying and selling. You have the world, because it's got to be on a worldwide basis, organized on the simple basis that production is solely for use, that you have people cooperating together to produce what is needed, to transport it to the places where it is needed, and you have free access to it. People take out of what is produced what they need. Now, this is, of course, the great question. It is said, and this is not new, that you cannot do this on a large scale. You couldn't do it on the scale of the United Kingdom, we are told, and you certainly couldn't do it on a world scale. Well, what a deplorable, despairing attitude this is. If, as we say, you cannot do anything with capitalism, you can't do anything with a system which is based on class division, which creates class conflict, constant friction, industrial strife, crises, and wars, if you cannot do anything about that, then you had better make up your mind. You must look for an alternative. Now, I know that it will sound to you utopian, as it does, obviously, to Sir Keith Joseph, that it is utopian to think of this. Why? What is there to prevent the world becoming socialist? Is it that the workers can't understand socialism? This is something we were told when the Socialist Party of Great Britain began. We were told, particularly by members of the Labour Party, socialism's premature, the workers can't understand it. They were elitist, people like Ramsay MacDonald. Lenin was another elitist. And we're asked to believe they could understand it, but you and I can't. We the great mass of people, we can't understand this. Well, I would throw it back. The Financial Times recently had a dealing with the European Economic Community argument, said that the people in favour of being in Europe used the argument that all the top brains are in favour of being in Europe. And the writer in the Financial Times said, well, look what the top brains have done to the world. Look at the shambles it's in. Don't be impressed by this. What we say is that people, workers, can understand anything, and there's nothing that the elitists can do that you can't. But what is the other obstacle to having socialism? It is this argument that people are incapable of cooperating with each other for their mutual advantage when they understand what they're doing. Why can't they? If we're told they can do it in a family or in a small community, after all, the large ones, only a larger number of the same sort of human beings, why can't they do it? Why can't they cooperate? And of course, we are never given an answer. What very often happens at our meetings, we'll be told by somebody, you know, human nature won't let people do this, and I know the sort of answer we always give. If you know somebody who is incapable of doing this, you bring him along, let's see him. Because we never get the people who put the argument who say it applies to them. I'm quite sure if I were to say to Sir Keith Joseph, do you feel incapable of cooperating with other people to your mutual advantage? He'll say, of course I don't feel incapable of it, I can very well do it.
You feel incapable.
You feel incapable of it.
I feel no
dialogue. Well, I do not take this despairing view, but I want to remind you that it is a despairing view, because if you don't take this step forward and view the world as a place in which human beings can cooperate, can understand, then you are stuck with what you are, and what you have got is not different because it is called the market economy. I don't know how much time.
Another
2.5 minutes. Well, a lot of things I would like to have dealt with, but as the meeting opened with a reference to Mr. Wedgwood Benn, I'd like to say something about a brief reference to him. It arose out of a statement also made early in this meeting about authoritarianism. Well, in a speech recently, as reported in the Financial Times, Sir Keith Joseph was reported as having said that the world, so to speak, is divided between authoritarianism and liberty, between Marxism and democracy. Well, I know this wasn't directed at us. In fact, he named a particular person, and the person he named was Wedgwood Benn. What I want to emphatically repudiate, and I'm surprised that it's ever been suggested, what on earth has Wedgwood Benn got to do with Marxism? I mean, I'm sure that Wedgwood Benn doesn't say that he's a Marxist, never has, and I suppose he's written 9 of Marx. You can read Wedgwood Benn's speeches. Do you find Wedgwood Benn saying, now, if you were to ask Wedgwood Benn, someone for whom he has respect, he might say, Keir Hardie, the father of the Labour Party. But if you were to say to Wedgwood Benn, are you in favour, as you are reputed now to be a Marxist, of abolishing the wages system, of having the world run on this cooperative basis, and to take Keir Hardie, are you in favour of what Keir Hardie said his aim was? And that is a system very much like the one described by Marx. Keir Hardie called it free communism on a world basis. Well, of course, Wedgwood Benn doesn't take this sort of view at all. Wedgwood Benn is not a Marxist, and the contrast in the world, the gulf, is not between Marxists and Democrats. We are Marxists, we are Democrats. We might claim, incidentally, that we're the most democratic party in this country. We are the only political party in this country that always allows our opponents to have questions and discussion at our meeting, and the only party that keeps open meetings. All our meetings, conferences, executive committees and so on are open to the members of the public. Reference is made to nationalisation, which, as I say, is state capitalism. It has nothing to do with us. But, of course, the Tory party is not in this position. The Tory party has a long history of nationalisation projects. I could name a few of them. They, with the Liberals, ran the nationalised post, telegraph and telephones in the 19th century. They formed the BBC, London Passenger Transport Board, BOAC, and in the last Tory government intervened on behalf of Rolls-Royce, Upper Clyde, Harland and Wolff, and when the Labour government came in, and Mr. Wedgwood Benn intervened to nationalise the shipping and ship repairing interests of Court Line, he very gleefully reminded the Tories he was doing it under an act passed by the Tory government. And going back still further, it is a belief among a lot of supporters of the Labour Party that they were the first people to pass a Railway Nationalisation Act. They're quite wrong. It wasn't 1946, wasn't the first, it was 1844, when Gladstone, who at that time was a Tory before he became a Liberal and was at the Board of Trade, in a Tory government, they introduced an act, a permissive act, to nationalise the railways. It was a normal capitalist practice. It was to threaten the railways that if they charged too much, they then had a monopoly, that the government would take them over. Nationalisation isn't anything to do with socialism, but it has to do with the Labour Party, the Liberal Party and the Tory Party. They are as much involved in this as anybody. And just lastly, in order to be right up to date, Mrs. Thatcher had something to say yesterday about it, which was reported in today's Times. She said, state funds should be made available when it was essential to assist an industry in difficulties, but not on a permanent basis. Well, you may remember when Heath came in 1970, he said he wasn't going to rescue any lame ducks. Well, it's a very, very tempting situation. If you are the government and your friends come along and say, look, we're in difficulties, help us, it's very difficult to refuse. What Mrs. Thatcher is really saying is, drug addiction's bad, we're going in for drug addiction, but only on a temporary basis. Once they get involved in this, of course, they get stuck with it. Because there are times when hundreds and hundreds of capitalist firms are in difficulties and can't get along without assistance. Mrs. Thatcher also said, I do not see that superb depository of talent in central government which could run industries better than those who have been concerned with them for many years. Quite true, of course. We're not advocating that the civil servants can run capitalism anybody better than anybody else. Nobody can run capitalism in a way which is satisfactory. But after all, it isn't only the civil servants. Look at the captains of industry, the whiz kids and so on. When capitalism's booming, you're told, and some of the city editors take this line, they say to investors, you follow X and Y. These are bright boys. They're booming ahead. Put your money there. Your money is safe, you see. And you hear a lot about this. One names no names. But when capitalism falls into difficulties, what happens? They cease to be in this position, they turn up in another situation. Their firm's gone broke. Or they've had a riotous meeting with shareholders who want to know what happened to that 10 million that they lost in speculation. Or they appeal to somebody to take them over. Or they go to the banks. Or they go along with their begging bowl to the government and say, please give us 10, 20, 30, 40 million, or we shall go out of existence. And get this point clearly. We are not saying that what is wrong with capitalism is either running it by civil servants or running it by tycoons and whiz kids and all the rest of it. This has really nothing to do with it. We say that there's nothing whatever can be done with capitalism, and you've got to face up to the fact that if you don't go in for socialism, if you accept this view that it is impossible for society to organise itself on this neutrally cooperative basis, then don't deceive yourselves. You are stuck with capitalism as it is and has been, no matter that it may now be called market socialism, which does not seem to me to be any different from what it has always been in the past.